This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we bring you breaking news on the Prairieland case in Texas, where a jury just convicted 9 activists on terrorism charges for a protest.
Join us as criminal defense attorney Javier de Janon tells us about the FBI records the government didn't disclose and what it means for the right to dissent.
We then look at the attacks on the Black community from the Trump administration through the eyes of Professor Kim Nestor Williams, professor of English and Black and Ethnic Studies at Sonoma State University.
Professor Kim mounts a compassionate defense of diversity, equity, and inclusion as a force of nature that Trump cannot and will not erase.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
In a case we're following closely, a federal jury in Texas has delivered a verdict in what may become one of the most consequential protest-related decisions in recent memory. 9 activists connected to a 2025 demonstration outside the Prairieland Immigration Detention Center were convicted on charges ranging from rioting to providing material support for terrorism. At the center of the government's case was a claim that Antifa is a coordinated violent enterprise amounting to domestic terrorism. Prosecutors argued that common protest tactics, black clothing, encrypted messaging, even reading certain literature, were evidence of a broader criminal conspiracy. But reporting by investigative journalist Adam Fetterman, based on FBI records he obtained through a Freedom of Information Act request, tell a very different story. The documents show that in 2018, the Bureau itself concluded that Antifa DFW, or Dallas-Fort Worth, posed no threat to national security and warranted no further investigation. Those records were not disclosed at trial, raising constitutional questions about withheld evidence and the integrity of the prosecution. We're joined today by criminal defense attorney Javier de Janon. Javier is the Mass Defense Director with the National Lawyers Guild, where he provides protest defense and support for the right to dissent. Based in North Carolina, Javier also represents individuals in politically motivated cases across the South. Javier, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, you've been closely involved in this case. At its most basic level, what happened at Prairieland, and how did it become a federal terrorism prosecution?
Certainly. So we have to go all the way back to July 4th, 2025. And whereas before, we would say things, you know, we believe this happened, we think this is what happened, now the federal trial happened. So we can say that this is actually the sequence of events that we heard from officers, from CCTV surveillance, and from body cam. On that day, July 4th, 2025, there was a noise demonstration that happened in that evening at the Prairieland Detention Center. And this is the essentially ICE detention center in North Texas in a town called Alvarado. A flyer went out, you know, on a big signal group chat and other communications, and people were called to come and make noise. The flyer, that's what it said, come, make noise, express solidarity. For those who aren't familiar, noise demos are a very, very common form of protest where people go outside of a jail or a prison and make noise to express solidarity with the people inside. In fact, in New York, there was a popular noise demonstration for none other than Luigi Mangione. We saw it in the news. Supporters went outside and made a lot of noise, and the media made a big sensation out of this. So it's not uncommon. That night, people showed up, and they brought fireworks. It is 4th of July. fireworks were put into the air. We saw in the cameras how some of them went over the fences, but they didn't cause any damage to any federal property. The noise demo was a success. People inside went to the window facing the fireworks. They were cheering. There was a lot of noise. And I think people felt good. Of course, the ICE wardens, the people who work at the ICE facility, called 911. And they reported falsely that someone was trying to break in to the ICE facility. And so Alvarado police responds. And, you know, as I mentioned, this is the town police. An officer arrives, and while the officer is arriving, one of the wardens actually tells one of the protesters, you know, leave, get out of here. And the protesters started leaving. I mean, they packed up everything and started walking away. When the Alvarado police officer gets there, his name is Lieutenant Gross, he steps out of his vehicle, sees some protesters who start running from the sirens, and immediately draws his firearm and aims it at the protesters who were running. After he draws in his weapon, that's when shots were fired in his direction. Later, it was determined that these came from a rifle. Then Lieutenant Gross shot back, and then at some point, he's hit on the shoulder, and the bullet kind of grazed his body. It caused no damage. He was in the hospital for a few hours. And that's it. That's what happened July 4, 2025. Noise demo, fireworks, and then the shooting. During the fireworks, however, someone did break out from the crowd. This came out during the trial. And this one person slashed tires, graffitied vans, destroyed surveillance cameras. And lo and behold, that person became a cooperating defendant. So we heard from him what happened as well and what he did on the stand. How this case became such a massive federal investigation and prosecution has to do with the moment we're living under the Trump administration, what people have called the Antifa scare. Because after this all happened, state police and state officers responded, but the FBI and the ATF very, very quickly took over the scene and took over the investigation. And then all these prosecutions happened, house raids were conducted, phones were surveilled, cars were followed. I mean, the whole nine yards of a federal investigation.
Javier, who are you representing individually, and what have been the core charges against your client?
I have the honor of representing Elizabeth Soto in her state-level case as part of the People's Law Collective. And that's key. Liz and many others have both federal and state charges. I'm on the state level case. When this all began, as I described, it was a state investigation. And so all defendants initially had state level charges, and they were indicted in Texas under the RICO statute, a charge of aggravated assault with a firearm of an employee, right, the officer who was shot, and a domestic terrorism charge under Texas under the same theory of the shooting. So Liz and many others have these charges. After the state charge gets indicted, then there's a federal information and eventually a federal complaint and a federal indictment. At the federal level, Liz and others were charged with riot, using explosives to commit a felony, the fireworks, and it was the riot, and then material support for terrorism as well. And then other defendants at the federal level were also charged with attempted murder, you know, of the officer, and they added attempted murder of two ICE wardens that I described were there. On top of those charges, there's a myriad of what I would call, you know, concealment, destruction of evidence charges. One of them federally, Des Sanchez, the only thing he did was move a box of zines, and the government got a conviction off that, saying that that was concealing evidence. And then at the state-only level, there's a myriad of destruction of evidence charges for people deleting signal threads, removing people from messages, and so on. So the number of charges is both in two jurisdictions and also extremely varied. In total, to date, there have been 19 Prairie Land defendants.
Javier, can you talk a bit about how prosecutors try to build the argument that Antifa operates as a coordinated criminal or terrorist enterprise?
During the federal trial, we saw essentially a jigsaw puzzle that the federal government tried to build. And the pieces didn't really fit, the story didn't really make sense. And the way they created this imagined North Texas Antifa cell, this is what they call it, is by connecting the dots basically on ideology. So they showed pamphlets that are anti-government, they showed zines that talk about, you know, using firearms in self-defense, they showed stickers and other political insignia against the police, against the government, right, calling to overthrow it, and so on. And so with all this literature, I would say, they glued together what they claim is the North Texas Antifa cell. We heard, though, again and again from the cooperating defendants that doesn't exist. There are groups such as a book club, the Socialist Rifle Association, some mutual aid groups. They do exist, and they do exactly what they say they do. The government alleges that all of these groups are essentially a front, and that underneath it is this sinister terror cell. I mean, they went as far as saying that a book club that verifiably all it does is read books and has book assignments and book homework, that is the front to recruit for the Antifa cell. After they put all these pieces together, the person who assembled the puzzle was a so-called Antifa expert, Kyle Schiedler, I believe is how you say his last name, but I'm not sure. And the so-called Antifa expert grabbed all these pieces and said, this is proof that there's a terror cell. They were using Signal, they were wearing all black, they had pseudonyms, and all these real groups, right, what we would call, yeah, these are real groups with real organizing, they're but fronts for the real terror cell. I still don't know, I mean, what the objective of this terror cell is. The expert couldn't point to leadership. Even the expert admitted that he did not review any peer-reviewed publication. Everything he's concluding is based on things he found on the internet, essentially, public source material. And even the judge, near the end of the trial, expressed frustration at how the case had become about Antifa when the charges themselves didn't have anything to do with it. What is most concerning to me about this case, though, and talking about fascism, is that even though the government failed to establish a North Texas Antifa terror cell, even though many people again and again said that doesn't exist, after the guilty verdict, the Department of Justice issued a press release asserting that they did get convictions based on a North Texas Antifa terror cell. But if you look at the verdicts and the charges, they have nothing to do with political organizations, criminal intent in an organization. In fact, none of the charges even required an enterprise. But now we're here with these verdicts, and so the federal government is twisting the truth, as it tends to do, and saying that they did get a conviction against a terror cell.
Javier, a few hours ago, on the day we're taping this, investigative journalist Adam Fetterman, who's long covered domestic protest activities vis-a-vis government overreaching, just published an article talking about FBI records he had gotten through the Freedom of Information Act from several years ago showing Antifa, these are FBI records, Antifa Dallas-Fort Worth was previously deemed not a national security threat. The prosecution did not share those records with the defense. How significant is this development?
I had the privilege of being interviewed by Adam Fetterman for this, and so I was able to hear about it, and my jaw fell to the floor. I mean, during the federal trial, one of the theories about the Emma Goldman Book Club, one of the book clubs that they say is recruiting for Antifa, the Emma Goldman Book Club was connected historically to what they call DFW Antifa. It seems that social media accounts were shared. It seems that organizers from DFW Antifa then became organizers of the book club. And they drew this lineage and they said, you know, this is it. That's why it's a front, because it's actually DFW Antifa. Don't be confused. They say it's a book club, but it's Antifa. So when I heard that in 2018, the same agency, the FBI, had investigated DFW Antifa, and the same agency said DFW Antifa is not a criminal organization, I mean, I was mind blown, because that's exactly what they said during the federal trial, the complete opposite. I believe that if the defense had received the, I suppose, first Trump administration's investigation into DFW Antifa, if the defense would have that in their arsenal, they would have shown to the jury, they would have confronted the expert in that there is no such thing as a terrorist organization called DFW Antifa. I know from Senate hearings during Trump's first administration that the FBI did confirm this, that Antifa is not a terrorist organization, it's not organized as a group, it's simply an ideology. But, you know, with our country's amnesia, now Trump is saying the opposite again, and this time now with a conviction. So this is a very big development, and for me, it also is the tip of the iceberg, because what else did the FBI investigate in 2016, 17, 18, related to this so-called Antifa cell, right? The Antifa lead. What other conclusions did the agents make back then? And how is it possible that they claim that now it was a cell all along if they concluded the opposite years ago? I am curious what happens at the federal case now that this story broke. But in the state-level case, which I'm a part of as a defense attorney, this is huge, because at the state level, the government does need to show a criminal enterprise for the RICO charge. And if the federal government already concluded there was no criminal enterprise, how could they possibly say it exists now? It's definitely something to keep our eyes on, and I hope that there's a shift in the federal cases, but it might be hard given the context and also the antagonistic federal judge overseeing the cases.
What was the prosecution's duty to disclose that evidence? Some of us know the case of Brady versus Maryland and the prosecution's duty to disclose exculpatory evidence. Could that be used to move for a new trial or on appeal from that those convictions?
The case of Brady versus Maryland is one of the seminal cases that we all learn in law school now. I mean, in criminal procedure and con law, to become a lawyer, you know Brady. And even, you know, fans of CSI and these law TV law shows know about Brady. Brady, the government needs to turn over evidence. The government can't hide its cards when there's exculpatory evidence. Based on, as I mentioned, this tip of the iceberg, I do suspect there is more to this. There's more evidence that would show that there is no such thing as an Antifa terror cell. And I think that's part of the challenge with this case. The federal government introduced into evidence things that in some ways have nothing to do with the charge of riot, the charge of using explosives to commit a felony, but they did. They introduced across multiple witnesses over 3 weeks all these references to an organized criminal enterprise. And so if that was their theory, if that's how they believe they could prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, they must have, they should have disclosed everything that would contradict that, that would exculpate this defendant, that would show that no such thing existed. I've heard the comment, well, that was years ago, right? Where this was a 2025 incident, that was a 2018 investigation. But as I mentioned, the federal government itself drew a line between DFW Antifa and other leftist groups and the groups and organizers that were around or that are defendants themselves. And so I think it is a clear evidentiary issue, and it might be a constitutional issue. The government used that criminal theory, that criminal liability theory, it should have given everything that would contradict it, and it seems that it didn't. I'm not sure if this was negligence. I'm not sure if this has to do with how the Trump administration has changed every single agent across all its agencies and removed a bunch of people who were career, professional law enforcement. I'm not sure. But the duty the government has is clear. They had to turn over exculpatory evidence. And I am curious what happens at the trial level, at the trial court level, with this development. But it'll definitely come up on appeals if it doesn't go for the defense's side at the trial court level.
You referenced the judge. What concerns have been raised about how he handled jury selection and discovery?
The presiding judge in this case, Judge Mark Pittman, was appointed by Trump's regime during his first administration. And in many ways, Judge Pittman is the judge that we kind of heard about in Project 2025. Judge Pittman created the Federalist Society in his area. He is young, he's conservative, and he really does not care what the Fifth Circuit tells him. He's actually been reversed several times by the Fifth Circuit on many decisions that happened again in this case. And during the trial, throughout it, we heard again and again from Judge Pittman, "I can't wait to see what the Fifth Circuit tells me about this," in some ways taunting the appellate court. So Judge Pittman oversaw this case, and from the get-go, he put this in what people called a rocket docket. He accelerated this very unprecedented and huge prosecution and set a trial date as quickly as procedurally possible. He denied all continuances at the very end, at the final trial date. And as he was setting trial, he quickly started ruling in very concerning ways. Even before the mistrial was declared, Judge Pittman sanctioned lawyers $500 each for filing discovery motions that he deemed frivolous. And this is pretty outstanding. He also forced an attorney to withdraw, claiming that that federal attorney wasn't local, and Judge Pittman was going to impose a local rule that requires counsel to be based a certain radius within the courthouse. Essentially, he threatened contempt to that federal defense attorney and forced a withdrawal. He also set extremely tight and strict deadlines for this trial that was, again, unprecedented with massive amount of evidence, massive amount of surveillance and investigations. And when the trial finally arrived, he set very tight rules for how the proceedings would go, setting time limits for the defense and the prosecution. And then, I mean, this case really turned to the next level at the news cycle when a jury was being selected, and because of a federal defense attorney's shirt, a civil rights shirt, as the jury was already getting selected and the defense was presenting the questions, the voir dire questions, the judge says that he is forced to declare a mistrial because the t-shirt that the attorney wore had contaminated the jurors and inserted bias into them. Now, there's case law, even in the Fifth Circuit, that the judge should have inquired to the jury, right? This is so normal, to see if the supposed contamination would affect their judgment. But he didn't do this. Instead, he declared a mistrial. The government and the defense opposed the mistrial, but he did it anyways. People's theory is that it's because the jury that was being selected was very immigrant-friendly and defendant-friendly. That's people's theory that maybe one day we'll know if that's what happened. But in any case, he dismisses the jury and says it's a mistrial, calls for a brand new jury, and then sets even further restrictions to this case. He cuts down the hours that the defense and the prosecution are allowed for their cases. He moves the case to a smaller courtroom. He declares that to view the proceedings, you have to go to Dallas courtroom for the overflow space on a screen, essentially. Dallas from courtroom from the Fort Worth federal courtroom can take you an hour driving. And he also limited even more the objections and the procedures for this tightly run trial. And so with this context in mind, this is the judge that defendants had to face and their attorneys to fight against a presumption of innocence, to fight for a presumption of innocence. Many people have commented that Judge Pittman might have stacked all the odds against defense because of his rulings and because of the way he ran the proceedings. From my own perspective as a defense attorney, if a judge is threatening contempt sanctions just for people doing their job and zealously advocating, that is very concerning for how the trial ended up. Because this is the same judge that rules on your motions, on your objections, and eventually will get to decide sentencing.
What precedent could this trial and verdict, if it's upheld on appeal, set for activists, journalists, and even loosely affiliated supporters? And does this pose a serious First Amendment threat?
The short answer is yes, this very much poses a First Amendment threat. I think what the federal government has successfully told people, signaled, is that if you dare hold a noise demonstration outside of an ICE facility, the federal government will seek the highest possible prosecutions against you. And it won't stop there. It will raid your house. It will take your phone. It will seize your car. This is what happened across North Texas. The chilling effect of this case can't be overstated. And even though we are seeing demonstrations and protests against ICE spreading everywhere, one of the tools that the federal government has at its disposal is prosecuting them and continuing to prosecute them. From a legal perspective, when you have a Department of Justice issuing a press release saying, "We convicted the Antifa cell," that gives more grounds for another press release saying, "We are now indicting this other Antifa cell." Even though, as I've explained, this is all based on fake news and false information. These cells do not exist. I think that the precedent this case sets, however, can be fought back politically as well by continuing to stand up for immigrants and, crucially, supporting the Prairie Land defendants. They have a very long road ahead of them, and there are state-level defendants who still have charges pending and whose court dates are coming up. And so I think even though this might be another era for repression in this country, the defendants that are actively facing the charges still need support and can still fight back. And perhaps, you know, a year, 2 years, I mean, I hope in a couple of months, whatever happened during that trial continues to get questioned, decisions get overruled, and other things get reversed. Might take a while, but without the support of the people, be it socially, politically, financially, I don't know if we'll get there, but I hope we do.
Oh, Javier, this has been just wonderful. We like your positive outlook and all your hard work. We want to have you back on to discuss developments as they unfold. But for now, can you remind us of the Prairie Land Defense website?
Certainly. Thank you. So it's easy. PrairielandDefendants.com. And there you can find every way to plug in. You can write letters. You can donate. You can host a fundraiser for the donations. And you can find out more about the case. The best part about the DFW Support Committee's efforts for me is that they have detailed notes of every day of the trial. So you can also read up on what happened.
So important. Thank you so much for being with us on Law and Disorder to discuss the breaking news in this case. And we'll be in touch again.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
According to the New York Times, within hours of taking office, Donald Trump immediately began to target the black community. On his first day, he ordered the dismantling of diversity, equity, and inclusion programs and the firing of the predominantly black employees who staffed them. He branded black history as unpatriotic and divisive. He equated diversity with incompetence and removed high-ranking black officials in the government. He moved to weaken long-standing civil rights guardrails, to restore what he called, quote, merit and fairness. By the end of his first term, Trump had slashed the federal workforce by nearly 300,000 people. His biggest cuts targeted agencies that had employed a disproportionate number of black employees, a measure that economists and experts say poses the biggest threat to the black middle class in modern history. Infamously, Trump recently posted a racist video clip on his social media feed portraying President Barack Obama and Michelle Obama as apes. Trump deleted the video but refused to apologize for it. To discuss racism in Trump's America, we're very pleased to be joined by Professor Kim Hester Williams. Professor Kim, as her students refer to her, is a professor of English and Black Studies and Ethnic Studies at Sonoma State University. She is co-editor of the award-winning collection Racial Ecologies, published with the University of Washington Press in 2018. Currently, she serves as co-editor of the journal Legacy, a journal of American women writers, and previously served as guest editor for the special issue of Gothic Nature 5, Decolonizing the Eco-Gothic. She also published a co-authored essay, Familial and Communal Histories as Environmental Care Work, in the academic journal Environmental Communication. Additionally, Professor Kim writes poetry grounded in the eco-feminist black womanist tradition of poetics. Last year, she published her poem, I Saw a Butterfly, in Voices Unbound, an anthology of international poetry. I recently had the pleasure of interviewing Professor Kim following a screening of the movie Origin, based on the book Cast by Isabel Wilkerson. It was so illuminating that I wanted to continue the conversation. Professor Kim, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
As we commemorate the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence this year, it's important to remember that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. described the founding as a promissory note, a promise that all men are created equal. But he also reminded us that that promissory note remains unpaid. It still remains unpaid almost 60 years after he said that. Where does America stand today in the struggle for racial equality?
Well, that is an excellent question. And I will confess that your introduction may be very emotional. It was emotional to be reminded of the anti-blackness of this Trump administration. It is virulent. I'd say in modern presidential history, pretty unprecedented and so aggressive as to be shocking, actually, to me, given the fact that we have made such strides in for racial equality in the last 50 to 60 years, especially, I would say, the last two decades in particular, with the election of President Clinton, who definitely wasn't perfect. He certainly, did some harmful things to the black community vis-a-vis economics, vis-a-vis, for instance, the welfare reform. However, he was also seen by the black community largely as an advocate for racial equality, for civil rights, for diversity and equity. And then, of course, we had the election of Barack Obama in 2008. And that was a milestone. We just had the passing of Reverend Jesse Jackson, who wept openly when Barack Obama was announced as president, that he had won the presidential election. My mom called me that night weeping and just in disbelief. And so that was a watershed moment, as the historians like to say, in racial politics and racial equality and civil rights. We never thought, many people like my mother, like Reverend Jesse Jackson, never thought that they would see a Black president. And lo and behold, it happened. But on the other hand, and as I've said many times to my students, and what the Afro-pessimist, which is a school of theory, Afro-pessimism, founded by Fred Wilderson down at UCLA, they never believed that we were in a post-racial moment, given that election of Barack Obama. And it turns out that they were right, that the backlash that we saw given that election, the night of the election, gathering of white politicians to say that they were going to do everything in their power to obstruct Barack Obama's presidency, and then the rise of the many wings of white supremacy movements, the white replacement theory, there are so many aspects of society, so many wings of society that came out to oppose his election and his presidency. I used to teach the media surrounding that we saw, surrounding the media coverage, as well as just the proliferation of images of Barack Obama in African, dressed as an African warrior, you know, in response to what they called Obamacare, which is really called the Affordable Health Care Act. And so just the amount of vitriol, as I said, directed toward the mere presence of a Black man and a Black family in the White House. Even Melania Trump at one point said, when she was moving, when she finally decided to move into the White House, or in the early days before the inauguration of Donald Trump, that she needed to cleanse all the areas that the Obamas had been in, that because they had been in the White House, they needed to disinfect the entire place. And of course, they replaced all the art, they replaced so many things that were there, even the garden that Michelle Obama decided to put at the White House. You know, the Southern California politician who posted a meme of the White House as a watermelon garden with watermelons all over it. So we saw just resurgence of anti-Blackness, racism, also misogyny. I don't want to, and it's Women's History Month, so we don't want to also ignore the fact that the Trump administration has brought on a lot of vitriol toward women, right? That was pre his election and has continued since. So anti-abortion, and just sort of the idea that women are not appropriate for leadership positions, and certainly not appropriate in his mind for the presidency, and that Black people aren't appropriate for the presidency, or as you said in your astute right point introduction, that many of the employees, people who had for decades been in positions, government positions, laid off, fired, and the threat to the Black middle class is very clear. He obviously, the Trump administration doesn't believe in diversity, equity, and equality, because they don't believe in fair housing. They don't believe in the merit idea is just a mask for white supremacy. We are living in a time right now where the struggle for racial equality is urgent, and has been highly threatened by this administration.
Professor, the county of Sonoma, where you teach, declared racism as a public health crisis in March 2024. It noted the 2021 portrait of Sonoma count found Black residents live 10 years less than any other racial or ethnic group in the county. Black people are 2.3 times more likely to be without health insurance. And Black and Latinx children are about 2.5 times more likely to live in poverty. How are your students experiencing these racial disparities? And how do you address racism in your teaching and your writing?
The history of Black people in this country, in the United States of America, is a history of two things: oppression, repression, and great just struggle, to use the term that Steve put in the question before. But it is also a history of resilience. It's a history of perseverance. It's a history of triumph over chaos, which is a quote from Ralph Ellison, famed author of Invisible Man. So I would say that my students understand racism because they experience it personally, consistently, as do I. Black and Latinx children grow up knowing that they need to be aware of their surroundings. They need to be proactive. They need to be people who are not deluded. And I go back to Fred Wilderson, and I know it's controversial. Afro-pessimism is a controversial theory. But I do go back to the idea that we need to transform the society. As Angela Davis said, we need to act as though we can, in fact, transform the society, and we need to work on it. We need to be actively doing that every day. We need to believe that it can be done, and we need to work on it being done. We need to actively be proactive and actively participating in social change all the time. And so Black and Latinx children understand that. They understand it implicitly. And so my students, and I am teaching a class called Black Poetics, in which I have a great number, more than I usually do, probably half of that class of 20 some odd students, they are students of color. They are Latinx students, they are Asian Am students, Pacific Islander students, they are Black students. What we do in that class is we started that class with the Dred Scott decision and the infamous statement by Supreme Court Justice Taney, Black people, not just enslaved people, he went farther than that, but he said Black people have no rights which the white man is bound to respect. That class began with understanding that jurisprudence and all the jurisprudence that dehumanizes Black people. But we move from that to resistance, to the idea of resistance. How do Black people respond and resist that kind of dehumanization, that notion of legal exclusion that is also economic exclusion, that is also social exclusion, that Black people have no civil rights whatsoever to be spoken of. And so we look at Kendrick Lamar, we look at Frederick Douglass, we look at Phyllis Wheatley. The students were working on the poem on being brought from Africa to America, the famous Phyllis Wheatley poem from the 18th century. And they examine in that poem, is she being sarcastic? Is she being sincere about her Christianity and being sort of risen up in social status and the status of human because of slavery? And students understand, of course not. There's no way that she could seriously believe that she was subhuman, but that she's clever enough to mask her critique in a praise of Christianity and also a true call to Christians to live up to their own creed, their own discourse, their own beliefs, right? Their own spirituality. And many scholars still examine the Wheatley poem to see how she navigates an anti-Black society, a society of enslavement in which she herself was enslaved, but to find a discourse that confirms Black humanity and also Black equality, human equality. As a woman, again, it's Women's History Month, so I have to say, as a woman poet, female poet, a Black female poet, she is an example of what needs to be done to address racism and to confront it and to, in fact, again, transform society. And the students are lifted up when they see Kendrick Lamar's Mr. Morale video, in which you have him in the coffin and then you have him floating above everything else. He rises from the coffin. He's in community. And then there's a scene with the police that disrupts the video, which happens in several Black musical discourses where the police come to disrupt what's happening in the community, which is joy. Black joy is how you address racism. Bad Bunny at the Super Bowl celebrating diversity is how you address racism. Being positive and understanding that the negativity, the kind of erasure that white supremacy is not who we are. It is not who we are as Americans. It is not who we are as human beings. To keep reminding, as Philly Sweetly does, remember Christians, Negroes black as Cain can be refined and join the angelic train. That line. That's how we confront racism. And we have our civil rights movement is alive and well. Voting rights, which are imperative at this point, because, you know, the Trump administration understands that they actually are in the minority. They actually are not the majority. Their ideas, their white supremacist schemes are not the way in which most Americans, most people feel and behave in their lives, everyday lives. Even people who are Trumpers don't necessarily sign on to that. Remember that famous when the person called into C-SPAN, the white male called into C-SPAN to say he regretted vote after that, the meme that you mentioned with Michelle Obama and Barack Obama as apes. He said, I'm ashamed that I voted for Trump several times. So I think that what we need to do is realize that we have to keep working and we have to build alliances because, and I love Indivisible. I've told Steve that many times. I love the name of it and I love the idea of it. And I love the kind of the force of it, the resonance of it. It's so beautiful because we are indivisible. And that's how we address racism. We do it in our teaching, we do it in our writing, and we do it in our daily action, our relations with one another, which are so important.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Steve Rohde, and my co-host is Heidi Boghossian. We're joined today by Professor Kim Hester Williams. Trump has seized on an attitude shared by some conservative Americans that the promotion of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and what is labeled wokeness, along with affirmative action, have all gone too far and in fact represent discrimination against whites. Is diversity, equity, and inclusion a valuable goal? And how do you respond to those attacks from Trump and other conservatives?
Well, I love this question. My favorite. This is my favorite thing to address. My favorite topic to address because it really reveals the hypocrisy of this administration. Their canceling of diversity, equity, and inclusion has nothing to do with the idea of wokeness or affirmative action or any of the things that they espouse. These attacks are about preserving a way of life that was discriminatory toward most people. And if we go back in history, we can see various times in which even quote unquote white Americans who were at the time not considered white, as in Irish Americans, were discriminated against because they weren't included. It is Nicole Hannah Jones, famed author and progenitor, as I would say, of the 1619 Project, came to Sonoma State, and I co-moderated conversation with her. And she said something that I thought was just profound, and that is that for you to lose your mind and become so irate over the idea of including people, of widening the net of opportunity. First of all, it's very anti-American. And I will say that as a 19th century Americanist, someone who studies and teaches and is a scholar of 19th century American literature. The irony here is that many of the writers that we classic American writers, Herman Melville, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Henry David Thoreau, Ralph Waldo Emerson, I know I'm naming men, but those were the people, Margaret Fuller, Emily Dickinson, and I will add the Gothic writer, since I do write and teach about Gothicism, American Gothicism, Edgar Allan Poe. They literally wrote about the idea of being asleep, which is called somnambulism. One of the very first classic American stories by Charles Brockden Brown was called somnambulism, which is sleepwalking, which was a fear, which was something that a republic could not have, a citizenry literally asleep, literally sleepwalking, literally unconscious and unaware and not critically engaged in their society. That was a metaphor for the worst thing that could happen to Americans, to American citizens. So this wokeness idea is completely being weaponized in a way that is very anti-American, very anti sort of Republican American, right? The idea of the Republic of America was the idea that you would have a very aware citizenry, a very woke citizenry. They use our own language against us all the time. They do the divide and conquer thing. They try to divide. They try to tell a certain segment of the population that they are just as Taney did, right? Just as Taney did with the Dred Scott decision in the 1850s. This administration is following that playbook by trying to tell a certain segment of Americans that they are more deserving than others. They're more deserving than immigrants. They're more deserving than Black people. Men are more deserving than women. Look how men have been set aside. Men have been discriminated against. Women have taken over. Black people have taken over. Immigrants have taken over, right? Latinos have taken over. On and on and on, so that you get just a small segment of the society who is enfranchised and who is deserving, right, of inclusion, of equity. Because it's not that they don't believe in equity and inclusion. They just don't believe in it for everybody. Just like Taney didn't believe in it for everybody. He certainly didn't believe in it for women, and he didn't believe in it for Black people. And he wrote a long discourse on it that I invite people to read, because it's incredible. It's amazing. It's mind-blowing to read that jurisprudence and to see the logic that is used to disenfranchise people. Diversity is not going anywhere. It's not going anywhere because nature is diverse. Humans are diverse, and you can't change that. The only way that they would ever be able to change it is to just exterminate everyone, including themselves, by the way. It's just a smoke and mirrors type of thing. It's just a way to distract us and to get us all worked up and to feel like, you know, and to question ourselves, to question what we know is correct. And that is that we know that nature is diverse and that we as human beings are diverse and that we need to learn to get along with one another in an equitable way, in a just way, so that we don't have conflict that is destructive to our environment and to ourselves and to our communities. The logic there is sound. There's no debating that, other than to say, again, one particular segment of the population is somehow more deserving than everybody else, which is what diversity is. Diversity is everybody. You're either going to have nobody or everybody. You can't have it both ways, because it's not sustainable to have an elite group of people, 1%, if I may, in charge of 99% of the people. At a certain point, 99% of those people are just not going to have it. And we've seen this throughout history.
Professor, we're running out of our allotted time, but we should note that we're recording this interview on the eve of No Kings 3. And in your final notes to us, are you optimistic that the groundswell of resistance nationally will succeed in combating rising authoritarianism? What role specifically do you see for the generation of students you're teaching to play in building a fair, just, and multiracial society?
Thank you, Heidi. Great question. I will say this. I'm Black, so I must be optimistic. My entire existence is because of people like Phyllis Wheatley, who are optimistic. People who like Frederick Douglass, who are optimistic. People like Angela Davis, who remain optimistic and persistent. People like Jesse Jackson, who are optimistic to the end. That is my legacy. That is my heritage. Those are my ancestors. I have Black children. So I have no choice but to be optimistic. And I'm a teacher. And I see it in the faces of my students all the time. Not only do I see optimism, I don't see as much of it as we used to before the Trump administration, but I see their determination. And I think the No Kings protest are evidence of the resistance that we will continue to see until we see the transformation of the society that is necessary and is inevitable.
Professor Kim Hester Williams, thank you so much for joining us today and on Law and Disorder and for everything you do in your work and your writing.
Thank you so much for having me today.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.